10. Communist intelligence successes, Western failures, and the crisis in Western studies. At present, Western efforts to obtain secret political information on the communist world, Western attempts to analyze information from communist sources, and Western ability to distinguish between reliable and unreliable sources. Between genuine information and disinformation, all appear to be suffering from at least a temporary loss of effectiveness. This state of affairs is symptomatic of the penetration of Western intelligence services by their communist opponents. Western intelligence has not always been unsuccessful. During the post-Stalin crisis, the communist intelligence and security services were weak. More people were disposed to help the West. 5 officials of Soviet intelligence defected in 1954. Although the West has never fully uncovered the extent of communist intelligence penetration of its governments and societies, Western intelligence did nevertheless have some reliable sources with access to policy-making bodies in the communist countries. But as the communist world recovered from its crisis, so its intelligence and security services regained their strength and effectiveness. The effort to penetrate Western governments in general and Western intelligence and security services in particular, which had been continuous from 1917 onward, was revitalized with success. This is not the place for a detailed study of the problem. Nevertheless, some examples to illustrate the argument must be given. From his service in the NATO section of the Information Department of the KGB's first chief directorate in 1959-60, the author knows that at that time the Soviet and bloc intelligence services had agents in the foreign ministries of most NATO countries, not to mention those of many of the non-NATO countries. This meant that the Soviet leaders and their partners were nearly as well informed about the foreign policies of Western governments as were those governments themselves. Symptomatic of the depth and scale of penetration were the cases of the former British Admiralty official, Vassal, the former Swedish military attaché in the Soviet Union and later in the USA, Colonel Winterstrom, the former senior official in NATO headquarters in Paris, Colonel Pax, and the 40 concealed microphones belatedly discovered in the American embassy in Moscow in 1964. There is also striking public evidence of communist penetration of Western intelligence services. The British Security and Intelligence Services, the oldest and most experienced in the West, were gravely damaged by Blunt, Philby, Blake, and others who worked for Soviet intelligence inside them for many years before being discovered. The exposure of the Felf Ring inside the German intelligence service in 1961 showed that this service had been penetrated by the Soviets since its rebirth in 1951. The author's detailed information on extensive Soviet penetration of French intelligence over a long period of time was passed to the appropriate French authorities, who were able to neutralize the penetration. American intelligence suffered from Soviet penetration of Allied services with which it was collaborating. In 1957-58, American intelligence lost an important secret agent in the Soviet Union, Lieutenant Colonel Popov, as a result of KGB penetration. Point one, particularly because the problem of disinformation has not been understood. It is doubtful if adequate account has been taken of the compromise of sources resulting from known instances of communist penetration of Western intelligence. Factors in communist intelligence successes. 3 main factors contribute to the successes of the communist intelligence services against the West. In the first place, they operate on a vastly greater scale. The intelligence potential of totalitarian regimes is always greater than that of democracies because they rely on secret police for their own internal stability. The determination of communist regimes to promote their system in other countries entails an expanded role for their intelligence services abroad. Accordingly, communist regimes take intelligence and security work more seriously and commit more human and financial resources to it than do democracies. In the Soviet Union, staff can be trained in these subjects up to the equivalent of university degree level. They are encouraged to enlarge their networks of informers on a massive scale both inside and outside their own particular territories. Second, communist leaders appreciate the importance of good security work to their survival and the constructive contribution that good intelligence can make to the success of their international strategy. Communist intelligence and security services are therefore free from the difficult, if not impossible, constraints imposed on the activities of their counterparts in democratic countries. They have an officially recognized and honored place in communist institutions. They have no problems to contend with from the press or public opinion in their own countries. They can afford to be more aggressive, especially in the recruitment of new agents. The third, and possibly the most important, factor is that from 1958, 60 onward, the combined intelligence and security resources of the whole communist bloc have been committed by the communist governments to play an influential part in the implementation of the new long-range bloc policy by assuming an activist political role, which has entailed providing Western intelligence services with carefully selected secret information from inside the communist world. It is an additional indication of the loss of effectiveness of Western intelligence that this change in the role of the communist intelligence services has virtually escaped attention in the West. Just as did the significance of the two conferences of leading KGB officials in the Soviet Union in 1954 and 1959, there has been no sign, up to the present, of any increased awareness of the new dimension of the problem posed by the involvement of the communist intelligence services in strategic disinformation. This seems to indicate that whatever secret Western sources there may be have not reported on it. Obsolete Western methods of analyzing communist sources. Up to now, Western analysts have normally used the content method of analysis of communist sources, principally the communist press and periodicals. Since the rules were formulated by the former German communist, Borkenau, it is often known as Borkenau's method. Without questioning the intelligence or integrity of Western analysts, one must question their continuing and almost exclusive reliance on his method after the new long-range bloc policy and the systematic use of disinformation had been adopted. The basic rules of Borkenau's method can be summed up as follows. Avoid being taken in by the facade of communist propaganda and strip away the empty verbiage of communist statements in order to determine the real issues and real conflicts in communist societies. Interpret these issues and forecast possible developments in the communist world before they become public knowledge. Seek clues for the interpretation of developments in the communist world in the national and local communist press and announcements of appointments or dismissals of officials and in obituary notices. Make detailed comparisons of the speeches of leading communists in the same country and in different countries in a search for significant differences, especially an emphasis on and approach to doctrinal problems. Make similar detailed comparisons between communist newspapers, other publications, and broadcasts in the same country and in different countries, with the same purpose in mind. Interpret current developments in the light of knowledge of old party controversies. Pay particular attention to struggles for personal power. Trace the background and careers of party bosses and study the grouping of their followers. This method was valid and effective for the period of Stalin's dictatorship and for the power struggle that followed his death. The elimination of the Zhdanov group by Stalin in 1948-49, the existence of Sino-Soviet differences in the Stalin period, and Khrushchev's victory over the majority of the Presidium in June 1957 were all susceptible to more or less accurate interpretation and assessment by these means. Point two, factionalism, policy disputes, political maneuvers, and the struggle for power were all real problems at that time, and the analysis of them on Borkenau's lines justified itself and provided a key to the understanding of the realities of the communist world and its policy. During the initial post-Stalin period, from 1953-1957, the most spontaneous and uncontrolled period in communist history, there were some new developments. Genuine nationalism and revisionism took on significant proportions. Different interest groups emerged, the military, the party, and the technical administration, together with groups of Stalinists and moderates, liberals, and conservatives. These new factors were taken into account by Western analysts, who modified their technique accordingly. However, the spontaneous period ended with the re-establishment of the authority of the communist parties in the bloc. Readjustments in the communist world reversed the original significance and meaning of the various factors studied by Western analysts. Since the latter failed to apprehend these readjustments, their method of analysis of communist sources was invalidated. The adoption of the long-range policy firmly established the principle of collective leadership, put an end to real power struggles, provided a solution for the problem of succession in the leadership, and established a new basis for relations between the different members of the communist bloc. Whereas the methods of assessing nationalism and revisionism were relevant to the crisis period of 1953-1956, in which there was a loss of Soviet control over the satellites and spontaneous revolts occurred, notably in Poland and Hungary, they ceased to be relevant once the leaders of the communist parties and governments had been given tactical independence, and all of them, including the Yugoslavs, had committed themselves to the new long-range bloc policy and international communist strategy. The forces of nationalism and revisionism ceased to determine communist policy anywhere, communist policy determined the use that could be made of them. It was because this fundamental change was successfully concealed from Western observers that subsequent Western analysis of Soviet Albanian, Soviet Yugoslav, Soviet Romanian, Soviet Czechoslovak, Soviet Chinese, and Soviet Polish relations, based on the old, obsolete methodology, became dangerously misleading. The re-establishment of the authority of the parties put an end to the influence of the interest groups. This can be illustrated with the case of the military group. Under Stalin, the military were a potentially important group because they were persecuted by him. They knew all about Stalin's methods from personal experience. For that reason, an anti-party move by the military was always a possibility. During the power struggle from 1953 to 1957, party control over the Soviet military was weak, and the military played a significant role first in unseating undesirable leaders like Beria and later, through Zhukov, in Khrushchev's victory over the opposition. After Zhukov's removal, the military came under sounder party control and were freed from the threat of persecution. Similarly, party control over the military in China was reaffirmed from 1958 onward. The military cannot and do not make policy in either country. The discovery by Western analysts of a military pressure group in the Soviet Union in 1960 and the emphasis on the role of the former Chinese Minister of Defense, Lin Piao, were both mistaken. The military leaders, like the so-called technocrats, are all party members under the control of the party leadership. In their separate fields, they are all active participants in the implementation of the long-range policy. Once collective leadership had been established in the Soviet Union and reaffirmed in the Chinese Party in 1959-60, factionalism lost its meaning. There could no longer be actual groups of Stalinists, Neo-Stalinists, Khrushchevites, or Maoists, but such groups could be invented if required by policy considerations. The personality factor in the leadership of communist parties took on a new significance. A leader's personal style and idiosyncrasies no longer determined communist policy. On the contrary, the long-range bloc policy began to determine the actions of the leaders and to exploit their differences in personality and style for its own purposes. Stalin used the cult of personality to establish his own personal dictatorship. Mao used it, in part, to conceal the reality of collective leadership. Since the adoption of the common long-range policy also solved the problem of succession, power struggles lost their former significance and became part of the calculated and controlled display of difference and disunity within the bloc. The existence of genuine groups of Stalinists and liberals, hardliners, and moderates in the Soviet Union is as illusory as the existence of pro-Soviet and anti-Soviet groups, or groups of conservatives and pragmatists in the Chinese leadership. It is true that there have been representatives of the older and younger generations in both leaderships, but attempts to find differences in the ideology or policy of the different generations cannot be substantiated by hard evidence. Both generations and both parties were, and are, equally committed to the long-range policy of 1958-60. When there was a real power struggle in the Soviet Union, it made sense to scan the communist press for clues, hints, and significant omissions. To read veiled criticism between the lines or to seek divergences of emphasis on a given subject in different papers or by different leaders in one party or in different parties. It made sense particularly in the years before and after Stalin's death. After 1960, however, continued analysis on these lines was not only useless but positively dangerous. Since the Bloc strategists knew all about the Borkenau technique and its cliches and used their knowledge in planning their strategic disinformation. They knew all the pointers on which exponents of the Borkenau method had come to rely for their insight into the workings of the communist system. They knew the fascination exercised by actual and potential splits in the communist world. They knew when and how to drop hints in the media or in private conversation suggesting apparent shifts in the balance between apparent rival groups in the leadership. They knew where and how to disclose the text of secret speeches and discussions reflecting apparent discord between parties, and, finally, they learned how to conduct controlled public polemics between party leaders realistically enough to convince the outside world of the reality of Soviet-Albanian and Sino-Soviet hostility while at the same time preserving and strengthening unity of action within the bloc in accordance with the mutually agreed long-range policy and strategy. The Western failure to detect disinformation and its current pattern. Conventional methodology tends to regard a secret source as reliable if the information it provides is broadly compatible with other information openly available. Conversely, a source reporting information that conflicts with the generally accepted view of the situation in the communist world may be discounted or rejected. In the absence of disinformation, this methodology would be valid. But the Shelepin Report of May 1959 marked the reintroduction of a systematic program of disinformation. It is true that in the late 1960s, an increase in communist disinformation activity, mainly of a tactical nature involving the fabrication and leakage by the communist side of alleged Western documents, attracted Western attention and was reported by the CIA to the Congress of the United States. But the fact is that when Shelepin delivered his report to the KGB conference in 1959, the West apparently had no sources capable of reporting on it. Its contents and implications remained unknown to and unexplored by any Western intelligence service until the author gave his account of them. Bearing in mind the public references to the long-range political role of the KGB at the 21st CPSU Congress, the good faith of any KGB source or defector who has described the KGB conference of 1959 and Shelepin's report to it as routine is open to serious doubt. Not only did the West lack specific information on the Shelepin report, communist use of disinformation in general has been consistently underrated in the West. And the purpose of the weakness and evolution pattern is virtually unknown. Point 3. If the West had been aware of the Shelepin report and had appreciated its implications, Western methodology should, and probably would, have been turned upside down. It would have been realized that a reliable source would give information conflicting with a generally accepted picture. The communist concept of total disinformation entails the use of all available channels to convey disinformation. That is to say, all the communist sources and all the Western sources except, obviously, any that are unknown to the communist side and those that, for some practical reason, are unsuitable. If the communist and Western sources reflect the same image of the communist world, it is a good indication that the Western as well as the communist sources are being used successfully for disinformation purposes. Against the background of the superior communist security and intelligence effort and its known successes in penetrating Western intelligence services, the odds are heavily against the survival of reliable, uncompromised Western secret sources at the strategic political level in the communist world. If, despite the odds, such a source were to have survived, it should have produced information at variance with that from all other sources. At a time when the facade and strength pattern of disinformation was in use, a reliable source at the right level should have drawn attention to the existence of a critical situation in the communist world that the communist side was anxious to conceal. Conversely, after the weakness and evolution pattern had been reintroduced in 1958-60, a reliable secret source should have drawn attention, in contrast with other sources, to the underlying strength and coordination of the communist world. Because the West failed to find out about or understand communist disinformation after 1958, it failed to change its methodology. It has continued to accept as genuine information from all sources, both communist and Western, reflecting disunity and disarray in the communist world. The fact that all the sources, Western and communist alike, continue to tell much the same story on this subject is a good indication that the disinformation effort has been both comprehensive and effective. The most dangerous consequence of Western failure to detect and understand communist disinformation and its patterns is that, in the absence of any correcting influence from reliable Western secret sources, the version of events transmitted through communist sources has increasingly come to be accepted as the truth. Conventional Western views on the Sino-Soviet split, the independence of Romania and Yugoslavia, the Prague Spring, Eurocommunist dissidents, and other subjects discussed in Part 2 were devised for the West and communicated to it by the communist strategists.